Hello and welcome to another very special episode of Let Me Explain You a Thing. My name is Andrew, and this is the podcast where I talk extemporaneously on a subject I know a decent amount about, usually on my drive to work, and that's the case today, so apologies for road noise and iced coffee noise, and I'm hoping the rain holds off just long enough, but we'll see. So today I wanted to talk about A Song of Ice and Fire theory, and I've been re-immersing myself in this world after watching A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, and it's just been, it was such a delight of a show. I regret that it was as short as it was. I mean, each episode, 30 minutes, roughly. And not like, you know, 30 minutes for cable, i.e. with commercials, so it's actually like a 22-minute episode, but like a full 30-35 minutes, and there were only six of them, I think. And I think apart from just being a little different in tone, you know, this world still has darkness. It is still incredibly classist and ableist and patriarchal. Like, this world hates women. It's kind of interestingly a little, I would say, the world of Ice and Fire is maybe in ways a little less racist and homophobic than our own. You know, not, like, totally accepting or tolerant, but, in some ways a little bit better. It's kind of a mindfuck, but anyway. You know, this world is very difficult to navigate for a lot of people, and even, you know, those of noble birth struggle. Like, we've seen some of the unique struggles that Sansa has coming up and growing into an adult woman in this society who is expected to marry whoever the men in her life tell her to, and, like, you know, whether those are caring caretakers, like a father who loves her but still has patriarchal notions of what her role is as a woman, or whether that's, like, just the people that she is essentially held prisoner by, who tell her who to marry, who to sleep with, who to bear children on behalf of, and hand them over to that family name so that they don't really belong to her anymore. We see this explored as well in House of the Dragon, and I think, interestingly, this was one element that House of the Dragon iterated on from the book. So, I guess, and, like, trying to make this point while also bringing things a bit full circle, A Song of Ice and Fire is a series of books that, when George set out to write them, because he has a background in screenwriting, it's not the only kind of, like, he was a sci-fi writer, published many short stories and novels through the 70s and 80s. And then in the 90s, his career, like 80s and the 90s, his career took more of a turn towards TV and writing teleplays. Like, he worked on the Beauty and the Beast show, live action show. And so he understands what can be put to screen, either in the form of television or film, fairly well. Like, he has worked in it. He has understood the constraints, like, oh, well, if we get another, like, character with speaking lines, then that means, you know, like, we're gonna have to pay another actor this much more, rather than if they can just, like, kind of be an extra and not have to speak and just, like, nod, you know, to communicate, then that's, like, that costs the production less, right? Or, like, well, if we go to this other location, if we, you know, if the story wants to set this scene someplace new, then we're gonna have to, like, that's gonna open a whole can of worms as far as, like, set dressing and props and, you know, are we gonna have to make it look good with populating it with other people, and, you know, does that mean costume and makeup and all these things? So, like, George knew when he was writing A Song of Ice and Fire, because of how massive the world and the story is and the number of characters, that he was writing something that would basically be impossible to adapt. adapt to screen. I don't think he did that necessarily on purpose, but it has been a topic of some note and discussion for some time. Like, we know this. And yet, they did it anyway, and each episode cost, like, $1 million or something. Or $10 million? Yeah, maybe that was it. Like, each episode cost, like, $10 million to produce. I think I've heard. And, you know, that's... Maybe that's on average, maybe that's later seasons. I think the first season, they did some things clearly a little bit more on the cheap, relatively. And Warner Brothers, of course, has, like, a deep, you know, collection of, like, costumes and sets and things like that, so things can look better. And this is why, like, people criticize, like, Netflix shows as looking cheaper or flimsier than shows produced by, like, for HBO or by Warner Brothers, because, you know, just... The material that they have access to is newer. Netflix has not spent decades developing a large library of all this stuff, the literal physical stuff that is needed to film TV and movies. A lot of filmmakers have to rent that stuff. Everything from cameras. I mean, like, no studios... I mean, I have to imagine larger studios own cameras. Most productions, they will rent them. They're still super fucking expensive to rent. Much less to buy. To buy is, like, impossible. Anyway. So where to from here? Yeah, A Song of Ice and Fire, famously very challenging to adapt, just... You know, from the premise of all the characters and settings and whatnot, the dragons, the magic, all these things that are very difficult, very demanding of a film or TV production. House of the Dragon. And the other problem with A Song of Ice and Fire, the books were not done when they started the show. They had just come out with the fifth book, and the sixth was anticipated at some point. And then the seventh, and they were hoping that they would get those. I remember, like, in 2014 or 15, people were still like, yeah, 14, people were like, oh yeah, like, if he comes out with Winds of Winter, then we'll be good to go. Like, they can write those, adapt those storylines faithfully from the book, and we'll be ready to roll for season six. Because each season kind of mapped roughly to a book. Although season three and four were kind of... Like, they put a major moment from the middle of A Storm of Swords as the climax of season three. So they basically, that book was dense enough they could break it into two. But, okay, like, by season seven, we need Winds of Winter. And, you know, as it approached, like, it became clear he just wasn't going to be doing that. Much less A Dream of Spring. So, at some point... viewers kind of adjusted their expectations to understand that we're not getting these books, and the show is just going to do what the show is going to do. And then House of the Dragon comes out, and the first show, you know, the material was all written. It was all out there in Fire and Blood, and a couple of short stories that Fire and Blood adapted material from, which were The Rogue Prince and The Princess and the Queen. Two stories that George had written for anthologies from the 2010s, and in, I think, 2018 or 19, adapted, as well as writing new content, into Fire and Blood, which is the first half of the history of House Targaryen, and leads up to the next reign after, maybe a little bit further than that, but after the Dance of the Dragon, so you get to see this climactic event, and then the aftermath. And the premise of this book, of Fire and Blood, is that it's written from the perspective of a maester, which is a scholar, you know, a historian within this world. He's writing, you know, drawing on, as many historians do, available source material, primary sources from the time, people who were firsthand witnesses, or, you know, in a position to be, to these events, and stood to recount, stood to be the people able to relay information. And it's very clear as you read it. For one thing, it's written in kind of a dry academic tone of voice, so it doesn't make for the most fantastically engaging reading. You have to kind of, like, the in the sense that the story doesn't, like, the book doesn't, like, reach out, like, two hands and, like, grab you and shake you and, like, you know, it's not a page-turner in that sense. You kind of have to be reading actively, reading between the lines, to understand why this is interesting or, you know, what this implies about not just the larger story being told, but about the main series of books. And that's why I would never recommend somebody read Fire and Blood until after they have probably watched the show and read all the main series of books. And also, go ahead and read the Duncan Egg novellas first. Like, those are actual stories and they're well told. And this is something for the sickos like me, you know? That's what Fire and Blood exists for. And the fact that it was successful enough maybe gives you a little peek into the size and power of the Song of Ice and Fire fandom, generally. Like, the fact that this could be a book that a publisher would be like, yeah, sure, let's fire up the presses. Okay, so, Fire and Blood, House of the Dragon, I think, adapted it well and interestingly, considering that, you know, what is shown on screen in an adaptation, you are, unless accepting situations like somebody's weird, like Damon's, you know, at Harrenhal tripping balls with the ghosts, and, you know, accepting people's, like, weird dream situations where you don't really know what's being, if what's being shown is real or true. Obviously, it's not true. It's a movie. You know it's not real. But we generally go into screen media with a sense that this story is, or, like, what we're being shown is what is happening most of the time. That is a general, especially, you know, and it depends from one genre to the next, but here we are, like, you know, we see, you know, okay, so, like, the author, the maester writing, Maester Yandel, supposedly, is it Yandel? Supposedly writing Fire and Blood from his perspective, based on the sources, such as Mushroom, a dwarf who is inclined to tell the most salacious possible version of events, and is basically, like, you know, trying to sell this big yarn about how everyone was fucking, and, like, you know, it, like, is making the story out to be pretty big and exaggerated, right? He's an entertainer at court, and that's kind of where his head is at. And then there are other, there's, like, a maester and a Septon Eustace, and, you know, what is the perspective of a Septon? It's probably going to be a little bit more prim and proper. These people have different relationships to King Viserys and Princess Rhaenyra, and, you know, they take different sides in this conflict. So Yandel does some of the work of sussing out bias, and he's not able to, there are times where his own bias kind of clouds the work of identifying bias. And, you know, there's a theory that the maesters, because they are a pro-intellectual group, that they want technocracy to be the rule of the Seven Kingdoms. They want to have And this is, you know, like a sort of conspiracy theory shared by a character within the story. Speaking to Theon after he has been reekified by Ramsay Bolton, and Theon is kind of viewed as, like, a non-player. Like, he is viewed as a broken serving man and not the heir to the Iron Islands. Barbary Dustin is the widow of Lord Dustin. She is also, you know, she was born into House Risewell, both northern houses, the Dustins and Risewells. She harbors a lot of resentment towards the Starks because she, for one thing, lost her virginity to Brandon Stark, who was the heir until, you know, the events that set off Robert's Rebellion. The Mad King killed him, the heir to House Stark, and he just kind of, like, threw her away after that. Like, I think she harbored some feeling that that could be more, and he clearly was not as considerate that, you know, virginity is a big piece of a noble lady's value in this society, and he has, like, by their act, weakened that. Also, you know, she missed out on an opportunity to be the Lady of House Stark. Like, that's a lot of power in the North. She also is resentful of Ned, because he took her husband, Lord Dustin, on his little escapade to rescue Lyanna from the Tower of Joy. He died in the battle at the Tower of Joy between Ned's little squad of, I think, 7 guys and the 3 Kingsguard that were posted there to defend Lyanna. And, you know, so Barbary Dustin has a lot of resentment towards the Starks. And she tells Theon of this conspiracy about, like, and it's maybe some projection, but she is definitely a believer of this theory that the Maesters of the Citadel have a political interest, have a political objective, and have been working towards it for decades, if not centuries. And she identifies that, you know, the Maester who was whispering in Lord Rickard Stark's ear. Lord Rickard was the father of Brandon and Ned and Lyanna and Benjen. She says that that maester, I forget what house or what lands he came from, but she says, like, yeah, he was the one who was pushing this inter-kingdom alliance that resulted in, and the maesters, like, tried to set up marriages between, like, Jaime Lannister and Lysa Tully, Lysa Arryn, nay Tully, tried to set up marriages between, like, Oberyn Martell and, I guess Cersei, yeah. There were a lot of marriages that they tried to establish to link all the kingdoms. What they ended up with was, and also fostering, Ned and Robert being fostered by Jon Arryn, and, like, suddenly you have the Stormlands in the north, two very disparate, faraway kingdoms united by the strong friendship of, you know, their heir and an elder son of their house. Within, you know, under the roof of Jon Arryn, who is the liege of the Vale, right? So what they end up with is this alliance. And then, you know, Brandon was set to marry Catelyn Tully. And, you know, and eventually, like, Ned marries her. And Lysa Tully marries Jon Arryn. So you have this, like, very strong, and Robert is betrothed to Lyanna Stark. So you have this very strong, like, network of alliances between the North, the Vale, the Riverlands, and the Stormlands, and they were pushing for more. And with that kind of strength and unity among the nobles, they were able to make a play for the throne and to depose the Targaryens. And there's also, you know, if you want to go back further in history, back to the Dance of the Dragons and before, the Maesters were at every turn, like, trying to avoid Targaryen unity, or trying to, like, make marriages and pacts that would set the Targaryens against one another, basically limit their ability to breed dragons and to hatch dragons. So, in a sense, a kind of nuclear disarmament was what the Maesters were working towards by trying to kill the dragons. And you can say, oh, but what cool and wonderful creatures. Yeah, but also what, you know, awesome and powerful weapons of war. Like, there's literally the Field of Fire, which was one of the battles during Aegon's conquest, where Aegon and his sisters light up, like, 10,000 men in battle and in one go defeat the Lannisters and the gardeners of the Reach. And that's how the Tyrells become the lieges of the Reach. They were like the steward house to House Gardener. But that ended the Gardener line. The ancient and historic kings of the Reach. And so, in, you know, one fell blow taking over those two kingdoms. And then that's when Torrhen Stark, the last king in the North, you know, met with Aegon and his sisters and knelt. And that's why he's known as the King Who Knelt. Kind of mockingly. And, like, yeah, that is kind of a badge of shame in a way to the Northmen. But also, like, he spared a lot of lives by not going to battle and getting roasted the same way the Westermen and Reachmen did. So anyway, that's why the Maesters, in part, might have been working for many years towards a world without dragons or magic. A world where that could be a little bit more democratic and not be ruled by people with, like, a certain powerful bloodline who can control dragons or warg animals or do sorcery. And, you know, like, it's kind of anti-fantasy to look at it that way and be like, yeah, cool, good job, guys. Like, you kind of want to root for people who are, like, cool ubermensch who can, you know, like, do magic and, like, there's something special about them. But then, like, this is George's deconstruction of this trope and stuff. Like, you look at that and you're kind of like, that's actually not great, though. Like, monarchy is bad. it's not just or right for one person to rule many in that way, absolutely. It's not ideal that power, whether, like, temporal political power or magic power, be passed down in some hereditary line. That kind of creates some perverse incentives around marriage and relationships and child rearing. You know, you look at the Targaryens and why they practiced brother-sister incest so gratuitously, like, that is why, like, you know, the stated reason is to maintain their power over dragons. And, you know, you look at that and you're like, yeah, this is icky, actually. This is not good. I know I'm reading a fantasy story and I want to believe in the power fantasy of individuals like this, but yeah, maybe I should think a little harder about that. And I think, you know, good on you, George. What a guy. Okay, what else do I want to get into? So I think, you know, the story behind House of the Dragon was complete when they started the show. That's great. The first season, I think, was adapted very well. They made a couple small, like, couple changes that I think ultimately don't change the end story, are a little smaller in light of things. Like, kind of planting a flag for Rhaenyra's children are definitely illegitimate children of Harwin Strong. That is a little bit more ambiguous. I mean, you know, it's never confirmed in the book. It's possible. Like, this could be a smear campaign. You know, there's a lot of ambiguity in the text. And the show says emphatically and clearly, these are not Laenor Velaryon's children. Like, they're just not. It's pretty obvious. And Harwin and Rhaenyra definitely did, literally, actually, yes, have a long-standing and recurring romantic relationship and affair. And Laenor definitely was gay. And not just gay, but would not, like, do his, quote, duty under the, you know, heteropatriarchy of Westeros and at least, like, try to father a child. Even regardless of his actual sexuality, which is something that you see, like, sometimes in the histories in this world, you'll see someone who, you know, quote, preferred the company of men or whatever, but, like, or, like, were they just set to do that, or are they bi, or, you know, did they just, like, hold their nose and, like, have sex with their wife so that they could have, you know, an heir, because that's, like, family name and legacy is everything. Anyway, and then, you know, a different situation for women who might not be straight, but at any rate, yeah, there were a couple things that were changed. I think generally the pacing of season one House of the Dragon was terrific. It covered a lot of good ground, and then season two just really dragged its feet, made some really weird decisions, like, Rhaenys, like, roasting a bunch of peasants at the Sept. Did she roast them? No, I guess she, like, smushed them with her dragon. Yeah, that was weird. I didn't like that change. I didn't like how they played it. I think there were changes that excited fans, like, oh shit, the dagger that, like, Joffrey ? Gives to the cat's paw to kill Bran, that was actually Blackfyre. That wasn't just, like, some, you know, like nice expensive dagger with a dragonbone hilt that was taken from Robert's, like, you know, wagon of weapons on the road, but it was actually, like, literally, like, the Sword of Kings. And turns out that the Sword of Kings was, like, a dagger and not a full longsword or something. Like, that was kind of cool. I could get into that. The idea that there's this, you know, Aegon's dream, this, you know, knowledge of the others and this prophecy that was passed down king to king. And then finally to Rhaenyra, and then the line was broken when Aegon took the throne, and Rhaenyra and Aegon, you know, nobody was able to transmit it to the next generation of rulers. Like, that's cool. I like that inclusion in the story. But season two, very slow. Anyway, Duncan Egg, what I like so much about A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms is that it's lighter. It's not jumping around from, like, character to character and scene to scene. Recently, as of time of recording, we put on, you know, we were in our full tilt for Duncan Egg, like, thinking about it a lot, enjoying the show a lot. We put on HBO, they have a, like, a sort of cable TV channel, essentially, for Game of Thrones. Like, they'll just, you know, show random episodes, and you can just kind of pop in whenever. And I like that, because I generally like that streaming services have been leaning towards this. Like, Dropout just put on, like, and Dropout is a very different kind of streaming service, but they just put out, like, a 24-hour, like, TV station, essentially, on their platform, which, you know, shows random episodes constantly, and, you know, it's sort of like a live stream, and you can dip in whenever you want. What's great about that is you're faced with, like, just an overwhelming abundance of choices when you're trying to watch something, and it's not, I don't know, it's just too much. There'll be so many times, and this is a little ADHD thing as well, but, like, there'll be times where I scroll through, like, several apps, my watch lists on several different apps, and I'll be like, okay, like, I guess I've been wanting to watch this for a while. Am I in the mood for it? I don't know. We'll put it on. And then I get 5 minutes in, and I'm like, I still want to watch this. I like where this is going, but I want to watch this with friends, or, like, I'm not really feeling it right now. And then I'm back to where I started. And I don't know. It's just like decision paralysis with streaming sometimes. So anyway, we put on the Game of Thrones station, and it was playing, I think season 5, episode 6 of Game of Thrones, which is a bad one. It is a lot of the goofiness, of Dorne goes on. What else happens? There's just, like, it was when the show really started floundering. Like, season 4, pretty good. You know, the changes that they make start to pile up, but, like, season 4, generally very good. And then season 5, I think, is, like, maybe one of my, probably my least favorite. I mean, there's probably others that are tied for least favorite, but season 5 just took a hard dip. And it was, like, a bunch of scenes in a row of Tyrion and Jorah traveling around, and the writing is bad, and then we get to Dorne and the Sand Snakes, and that whole arc just was a waste of time completely, and then it ends with Sansa marrying Ramsay, and, like, I could tell I was getting into that scene, and I was like, okay, this is not fun anymore. I don't want to watch this part of this episode again. An episode that seemed to really, like exult in shocking the viewer with sexual assault, and, like, fuck that. So, anyway, it just made me think about what I love about A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, which is, even in the ways that it's not a perfect adaptation, I think the acting, the writing carries a lot of weight. The story is simple, you know, it's very tight to the perspective of Dunk. You know, there are some decisions the show made that I think maybe didn't totally land for me, or, like, maybe didn't feel super obvious what they were trying to do, like him shitting in the first, like, you know, 5 minutes of the first episode. I'm like, okay, I guess this is just to, like, set expectations, and to show you it's not that kind of show of, like, magic and high fantasy and, you know, politics and cunning and heroism and stuff like that. This is just, like, some dude who's trying his best. But, I don't know, something about it, like, didn't totally work for me, and that's fine. At least at the time. I think it's aged a little bit better in my book, but anyway, apart from that, just so many very delightful scenes and interactions and in the things that were added to the show, like that steward who's, like, constantly hawking and spitting. It's, like, it's gross, but it's also, like, this is some guy with bad allergies in a time before Zyrtec. I don't know. I really liked a lot of the little details that they came up with, and the fact that it is more street level. It's not about, like, kings and queens and dragons. It's about some random dude who's, like, trying to afford rent. I don't know. I've said this before, but I really love in fantasy when a character, like, I really love personal finance in fantasy stories. Like the first Kingkiller Chronicles book, The Name of the Wind by Patrick Rothfuss. I haven't read the second book, and it gets much more heightened, much more elevated from what I understand. And he hasn't finished that trilogy and probably won't. And the last part of that book kind of let me down, but I really like the whole arc where Kvothe is trying to, you know, he's, like, living on the streets. He, like, has his stuff stolen repeatedly. He's trying to scrape together enough money to afford school, and, like, taking out loans and things like that. Or, like, Spinning Silver by Naomi Novik is about a moneylender. And then, you know, the book starts losing me when it becomes fantasy. But just the idea of, like, this, you know, scrappy character who's, like, a genuinely self-made person, like, comes from basically nothing, has no two coins to rub together, and, like, kind of figures it out. And I don't know, that is actually fantasy to me. That is a fantasy of a kind, for sure. And I like that kind of storytelling. I like how Dunk is like, well, I'm gonna get this armor, I have to sell my horse to do it, and if I win a tilt or two in this joust, then I'm gonna come out with more than I started with. If I lose and I have to ransom back my horse and armor, I'm not gonna be able to, so I'm gonna be without horse and armor or sword, and I'm gonna have nothing to my name. And I guess in that case, what do? I try to travel to Lannisport or King's Landing and get a job with the City Watch. Like, that's what he keeps thinking about as a fallback. It's like very, it's kind of bleak. Anyway, I just really love, like, the stakes are high, even though it's not about, like, major battles and, you know, the fate of the world and millions of lives and stuff like that. It's, like, about one guy's life, and is he going to be okay? Like, we care about him. He seems like a good guy. He's decent and honorable and stands up for people who, you know, get, like, bullied and oppressed by the most powerful, and he puts his life on the line and his body. And I don't know, that's just, like, that's a hero. And that's why Dunk is one of the truest heroes in A Song of Ice and Fire, and truest knights, even though he clearly was never knighted. Brienne is the same, and, like, she was knighted at the very end of the show Game of Thrones. That hasn't happened in the books yet. It might not. But these are some of the truest knights, like, people who live the values of, like, protecting the weak and less fortunate, and, yeah. Anyway. What else do I want to say? I guess that was kind of it. I had another topic in A Song of Ice and Fire world I wanted to get into, but I guess we'll save that for next time. And this has been kind of a recap about the adaptations of various Song of Ice and Fire media to television. Oh, I didn't even mention that all the shows that have been canned, like they canceled a lot of shows that were in development, like one about Jon Snow post Game of Thrones, or Arya post Game of Thrones. There was a more family oriented, I think, kids show that was going to be animated about Yi-T, which is a setting we've never been to actually in the books or other TV series, just heard about. There was going to be a show about, like, the creation of the Others and the first war for the Dawn and the Children of the Forest that they canceled. That was going to be way more high fantasy. I think the working title was Blood Moon. They canned that. And now, apparently, they're developing a movie, like a theatrical release film, based on Robert's Rebellion. And, no, Aegon's Conquest. I don't know how that makes for an interesting movie. Like, the story is just kind of these three blonde-haired people from across the sea roll up with dragons and, like, take over a kingdom with some resistance but little difficulty. And I don't know what the story is, but we'll see. Should be interesting in any case. But I think that's all I have for you guys today. Thank you, as always, for listening. Thank you to Scott Suter for the intro and outro themes for the podcast. Find Scott on SoundCloud at Scott Suter. Find Scott on Spotify under his projects Big Evil Eye and Tiny Stupid. He's done some really great work in a variety of genres. Go support him. Also, find me online at www.letmeexplainyouathing.com. You can send topic ideas to me there and other feedback. You can also Have a great day. Thank you for listening. I hope if you've been falling asleep to this, you've enjoyed the white noise. But otherwise, stay groovy, guys. I will catch you next time. Bye-bye.